kills Mordred, and Mordred sorely wounds him. So he's about to die. Sir Bedivere, one of his knights, comes, and Arthur says, "Here is Excalibur, my sword. Go and throw it into the lake." Well, it may be Lake Lucerne, I mean, originally. So Bedivere goes, and when he sees that sword, he thinks, "I can't throw this into the lake." So he puts it down, and he comes back, and he says, "Well, okay, I did the job." Arthur says, "What did you see?" "I saw a splash." "Go back. Try again." Everything has to happen three times before it works. And so the third time, he thinks, "Well, I guess I'd better do it." Throws the sword, and the hand of the Lady of the Lake comes up and takes it back down. And Arthur is then carried away on a boat by three fairy queens. You can see how the things are mixed up here, the old fairy queen mythology and the warrior mythologies coming together. Well, this is known as the whole history of Arthur. And it is the aspect of the Arthurian romances that was cultivated particularly in Britain, in England. He was, as it were, their ideal king. The stories go to the continent. The continent, France in particular, they're not interested in Arthur. They have a great king of their own, Charlemagne. So they become more interested in the stories of his knights, Bedivere and Kay and Gawain and so forth and so on. So when we carry the Arthurian romance from England to the continent, Arthur becomes just a figurehead. He's just there. And these marvelous adventures of the various knights at his round table begin to take over. Let me go back just one little bit. After Geoffrey of Monmouth had published in Latin the History of the Kings of Britain, it was immediately translated into Norman French verse by a man named Wace, W-A-C-E. And it's in Wace's Brut, B-R-U-T, that we find for the first time the Round Table. Where did the Round Table come from? It came from Ireland. You know the propensity of the Irish. They like a fight. They like a good fight. And there's a saying, for example, is this a private fight or can anybody get in? And any occasion would be an excuse for a fight. And in the banquet halls of the various Irish chieftains, one of the big problems was who sits at the head of the table. Oh, boy. Well, let's get rid of that. We have a round table, you see. So that's how the round table gets going. But when this round table is carried in Wass introduces the round table, in a Christian period in the 12th century, it begins to suggest the round table of the Last Supper, you know, and all that kind of thing. So you begin to have a melting together of traditions. So Wass is the first French rendition of these stories, and it immediately follows Geoffrey. And then in the next century, we have a translation into Middle English by a man named Layaman, L-A-Y-A-M-A-N, Layaman's Brut. And all of these give the whole history of Arthur. But now we go to the continent, we get something else. I hope you'll pardon all this historical matter. I'll be through with it just after this next chapter, the one I'm about to enter. There's one English date that I guess everybody in the room knows. 1066. 1066, the Normans, the Norman French, conquer Britain, conquer England. And so, you see what we have in England now. We have the old British, then we have the Anglo-Saxons, then we have the Normans. Now, you know how it is on the university campus. You have the freshman, and the sophomore, and the juniors. And the sophomores are always being nasty to the freshmen. Then, next year, everybody moves up, and there's another freshman class, do you see? And those who were the freshmen start annoying the present freshmen. who have kind of affinities with the juniors, because the juniors were fighting the Anglo-Saxons before. You know what I mean? So you have this three-layer cake, and the people at the bottom and the people at the top of the three layers are sort of together against the middle one. Well, when the Normans came in, they kicked the English out into the yard. The Normans spoke French. The English spoke English, or Anglo-Saxon. So in the dining room, we had French as the language. And out in the cattle yard, we had English. And that which was called a calf, that's a Germanic language, out in the cattle yard, is called veal, vol, when it gets on the table. And swine becomes pork. Nobody's speaking English, except the louts out there. So here are the Normans. The English are out. The Celtic bards became their favorite entertainers. No television those days. So what are you going to do? You got to have a story. And so these Celtic bards, the Celts were great, great storytellers. A Celtic bard had memorized thousands of stories and also knew the rules for changing the story to fit contemporary life situations. So the old Celtic myths begin coming up as stories of knights. The bards from Cornwall, from Brittany, from Wales, and from sometimes from Ireland were entertainers in the Norman courts. Now, the great Henry II of England had as his queen Eleanor of Aquitaine. If you want one incarnation of the goddess of the Middle Ages, this is it, Eleanor. She's born 1122 and dies 1209. Right, covers the whole period, Third Crusade, the whole business. She was the daughter, she came from Aquitaine, right on the border of Spain. And her grandfather was the first of the troubadours. She was married then to King Louis of France. She went to Jerusalem with him on crusade. He was a boar. One night, she just gets on her horse and rides away. He wakes up in the morning, there's no queen. Well, where's she gone? She's gone to England to marry another king. She marries Henry II. And her two principal sons were Richard the Lionhearted and John. Daughter, Marie de Champagne. And I think Blanche of Castile also. Three generations later, there isn't anybody on a throne in Europe who's not the grandchild of Eleanor of Aquitaine. And she was really, really it. But when she went to Henry, she brought with him sovereignty over Aquitaine and over the northern part of France. That's how we had to wait for Joan of Arc, 1431, she's burned to death, to rescue northern France from this British rule. So Henry II had this great big domain, and all the way from Britain to the Pyrenees on the border of Spain, the courts are being entertained by these entertainers. Now let me just tell you one of the stories. And you'll recognize it a little later as part of the Tristan story. There's a great Irish chieftain named Finn McCool, and he was the protector of Dublin. And he protected Dublin for several hundred years. And he had a troop of Fianna, as they were called, giants, who were his troops. And his nephew was Diarmaid O'Dyne. Now, Diarmaid had on his forehead what is known as a love spot. And any woman who saw that would fall passionately, helplessly in love. And so for the protection of the women of Ireland, he wore his hair over the love spot. His uncle Finn McCool, you might want to write down the name Finn McCool, you spell it just as it sounds. F-I-O-N-N-E is Finn. And McCool is M-A-C-C-U-M-H-A-I-L. Finn McCool. Finn was about to marry his 98th wife or something of the kind, and her name was Griana, G-R-I-A-N-N-E, or Grianny. So at the banquet, here's Finn, and here's Granny, and here's Dermot, Finn's nephew, and one of the principal lieutenants in this force. And Granny turns to Dermot and she says, "I'll see the love spot." He says, "Nothing of the kind." And she says, "I put a geis on you." Now, a geis is a dare. An Irishman has to accept a dare. "So, I put a geis on you," she says. And she pushes his hair back. She says, "We're off." And he says, "Nothing of the kind. I put a geis on you." So, I don't know how they managed it, but the pair of them get up from the table and they start running. And Finn catches on to what's happened, and he's running after them. And they run all over the face of Ireland. Now, when you travel through Ireland, or even Scotland and parts of Britain, you see these great megalithic monuments, you know, great stones, standing stones, which are called menhir. And then kind of great boxes of stone, which were the tombs over which mounds were built, and the mounds have washed away, and these are called dolmens. And all the dolmens over Ireland are called Dermot and Granny's bed. This is where they ran around. And the standing menhir is called Finn's thumb. Well, he's pursuing them. And one fine day, Dermot, he's a man of honor after all. And she put this geis on him, but he's not going to play ball all the way. So whenever night comes and comes time to go to sleep, he puts his sword down between the two of them. So they sleep that way. One day they're running away, and she steps in a puddle of water, and the water splashes up high on her thigh, and she mutters, "The puddle's bolder than Dermot." So Dermot says, "What was that I heard?" She said, "Oh, nothing." He said, "I heard enough of it. Tell me the whole story." Well, she says, "All I said was, it's the puddle is bolder than Dermot." So they slept without the sword between from then on. Well, now there was another geis on Dermot, and it was that when he hears the hunting horn, he has to go to the hunt. So Finn knew this and thought, "I know how to get that guy." So there was a great boar out in the west of Ireland on Mount Balbun or Balbrumman or something like this. And this boar had poisonous bristles, so all you had to have was one of these bristles prick you and you'd die. "Okay, we'll go for the boar hunt, and I'll blow the hunting horn, and Dermot will have to come, and the boar will get him." So Dermot and Granny are asleep one night, and he wakes up, he hears the hunting horn, and he moves to Sir, and Granny says, what are you doing? Where are you going?" He says, "I just heard the hunting horn. I got to go to the hunt." "Ah," she says, "it's just a dream. Go back to your sleep." So again, three times, and the third time, of course, he's got to go. That's all there is to it. And he goes, and of course, the boar comes directly at him and ducks under between his legs so that he's riding backwards on the back of the boar. He had tried to kill the boar when the boar came at him. He brought his sword down on the boar's back. The sword just fell apart, and all he had in his hand was the hilt of the sword. He's riding backwards. The boar dumps him, gores him just as he smashes the boar's head with this whole thing in his fist. So here are the two of them lying, dying, Dermot and the boar. By the way, when a god is killed by an animal, that animal is the animal aspect of the god himself. And so what you have here, Adonis was slain by a boar. Osiris was slain torn apart when Set, who was chasing a boar, found his body in the papyrus swamps. The boar keeps turning up, and here it is. Odysseus, Ulysses, had the scar of a boar on his thigh, and so forth and so on. So here's Dermot, a heroic character, but originally a deity of some kind, dying and resurrecting. Well, there he is, lying with his guts all over the ground, and the boar dying beside him, and along comes Finn. "Ah," he said, "it's a fine sight you'd be for the women of Ireland." "I wish I could see you in this condition." "Well," says Dermot, "you could save my life if you would." He says, "How could I do that?" He says only 9 paces away is the spring of the water of life. Just bring me a little bit of the water of life and I'll be cured. So Finn goes and he takes the water in his hands, and as he comes, he lets it go through his fingers. Oh dear, it's all dry. So he goes, 3 times he does this, by that time Jim is gone. So Finn and Granny lived happily ever after. He takes Granny back, and they have a happy life together. That was not a mad story, but there it is. And this is the story that lies behind the Tristan romance, as you'll hear in a little while. This is the kind of tale that was being told, transformed into knightly form. Now, these stories of Finn McCool are associated with Dublin, or the Leinster. In the north, there was another cycle called the Ulster Cycle. And the principal figures there were a king named Conachobar, spelled just as it sounds, C-O-N-C-H-O-B-A-R. And his nephew, Cuchulainn, C-U-C-H-U-L-A-I-N-N, Cuchulainn. And here you have uncle and nephew. And again, uncle and nephew. What does that mean? It means matrilineal descent, descent through the mother line. The mother's brother becomes the authority over the son. So this points to the old Bronze Age mother line inheritance echoed in these stories of uncles and their nephews. And I don't know how it is now, but when I was a kid and we'd get a guy down, we'd say, "Say uncle," you know? And then he'd say, "I won't." In the 17th century, when Cromwell ravished Ireland, the whole of the north of Ireland was wiped out. And he brought in then from Scotland a bunch of Protestants who are now the dominant people in the north of Ireland. These are 2 totally different people, 2 totally different religions. And that was the time when what we call the flight of the wild geese, when anyone who could just fled from Northern Ireland and went to join the Spaniards, who were England's enemies. And that's why in South America and Cuba and so forth, you find so many Irish names. It all comes from that time. So the Irish stories of the north have been preserved only in manuscript. They don't live on among the people. But the stories of Finn McCool live right on. There was a man named Curtis, Jeremiah Curtis, who made a collection of Irish fairy tales only at the end of the last century, and here were the same old, wonderful old stories of Finn McCool and Dermot and the whole lot of them. Well, these are the tales then that are being celebrated in the courts of Aquitaine and France and Norman Britain. Now, what was the culture life of that period like? We're talking only about aristocrats. This has nothing to do with the folk tradition from now on. There was a folk tradition, but that's not what we're talking about today. As you know, in traditional societies, people can't choose their wives or husbands. Love plays no role. The society decides whom you're to marry. And in the Middle Ages, particularly young women were used as pawns to join different dynasties and so forth. King so-and-so would give his daughter to the young prince of another place, and then there'd be a link and all this. And then the church would bless this, and you're supposed to be one flesh. Well, what you really were was one bank account instead of 2. Had nothing to do with what we think of as love. That's the way it is and has been in most societies of the world. But in medieval Europe, 12th century Europe, the idea grew up, this is an abomination. And the love cult emerges in the 12th century. The first of the troubadours, Elna of Aquitaine's grandfather, date about to 1100. And that whole century, the whole 12th century, is the century of the troubadours and courtly love. And it's into this tradition of courtly love that the old Celtic stories are brought. Do you get me? We have the old Celtic stories, Bronze Age and Celtic mixture, brought into the Norman and French courts by Celtic bards for the aristocrats. And the world into which these stories are brought is that of courtly love. Question about love. Until this tradition in Europe of courtly love, there were really basically two ideas of love. One is lust, which I simply define as the zeal of the organs for each other. And it doesn't much matter who's on top. And so this is impersonal, basically impersonal. And the other is agape, or spiritual love, love thy neighbor as thyself, which is impersonal. Against that comes the troubadour idea of amour, A-M-O-R. That's a Provençal word. In French, it would be amour. What's the difference between amour and lust or agape? The troubadours spent a good deal of time trying to analyze the psychology of love, and they would write poems about it. And the poem that seems to me to catch it best is by a man named Giraud de Bognay, G-I-R-H-A-U-L-T, Giraud de Bornay, B-O-R-N-E-I-L-H. Now, this wonderful poem of Giraud de Bornay. He says, the eyes are scouts for the heart. Now we're going to have a personal encounter. The eyes go forth to find an image to recommend to the heart. And if it is a gentle heart, that is the key word of the whole medieval aristocracy. Sometimes it's called the noble heart, sometimes the gentle heart. That is to say, a heart that is capable not simply of lust, but of love, then love is born. So, outside of marriage, this elegant jet-set game of courtly love was being played. Now, the woman's problem, when approached by a suitor, was to determine whether he had a gentle heart. And this involved delaying him and giving him things to do meanwhile. Tasks. For instance, if he were a sturdy chap, good with a lance, send him out to guard a bridge. Now, traffic in the Middle Ages was somewhat encumbered by youths guarding bridges without any purpose but to make a thing for his life. When anything like an act that is done for an economic or political purpose, this is gross. Just foolishness. If, on the other hand, he was better with poetry, his job was to write poems to and about her in such a way that her name would appear in the poem, but her husband wouldn't recognize it. And that's the beginning of all the intricate medieval verse forms, of which he inherited. I spent 2 years working on Provençal poetry when I was in Paris. And I tell you, it gets to be an awful bore, because there's not much you can say. But complicated is no name for it. One story that I read at that time that I just love is a young man who falls in love with the very sound of a woman's name. And he goes with a friend. You always have a friend on these trips. And to the castle where she is, and he finds that her husband is so jealous and so nervous about it all that he just doesn't let her out of the house. Oh, yes, he does. For Mass on Sunday. And you know, when she goes to Mass, then she has to approach the altar to receive communion. Ho, ho. So this young man gets a job with the priest as the altar boy. And I don't know whether you all know how it happens in Catholic communion, but when the priest is giving the host to somebody, the altar boy holds a little pallet under the host so that no crumbs should fall on the floor. So So the priest and this lover, intending, comes along, and when it comes to this lady, he says, the first week, je, and goes on. And the second week, oh, she saw, whoa, that's coming next. second week, he says, came. She goes back to her girls, and oh, and she's kept in a tower. And when her husband lets her go to Mass, brings her to Mass, he puts her behind they have a very special place built in the church to protect this woman from even being seen. But she did go up for communion, and boy, the devil has broken through. Je t'aime, my gosh. So he says, je t'aime, je t'aime, je t'aime. So she writes down a bit of information for him that's really secret information, that once a month, I guess it's the second Thursday of every month or something like this, the town baths are cleared of all people except her and her maidservant. So this young man with his friend start about half a mile away digging a tunnel. And one fine afternoon, second Thursday of the month, this pair emerge in the bath, and the technical word in the Provençal is jazir. They jazir to their heart's content the whole day. That give you an idea of the spirit of all this. Then some of the ladies, probably Elnor, but certainly Mary de Champagne, had courts that judged cases. And one of the axioms of the court was, love and marriage could not exist together. And we have the case of one chap who comes to a lady and proposes himself, and she says, I have a lover already, but if I ever dismiss him, you can come to the door, we'll see. So finally her husband dies and she marries her lover. Mm-hmm. Number two presents himself. And she says, no, I've married my lover. And I'm living. He said, this is against the rules of the game, and I'm going to bring this to the court. And he did bring it to the court, and they said, by rule number 921 on such and such a date, it was declared that love and marriage could not exist together. So, madam, that's the way it works. Do you want a break? No? Okay. So now we come to the Arthurian romances on the continent in this atmosphere. The earliest poet to render these oral recitations of the bards into prose, into verse form written, was Chretien of Troy, Chretien, with a circumflex over the E, Chretien, de, and in Old French they would have said Troyes, Troyes. In Old French, all of the consonants are pronounced. And you don't have the wa. The wa comes into French at the time of the French Revolution. Françoise would be the way they would have said Francis. Chretien was the court poet of Marie de Champagne, who was the daughter of Elnor. And with her instruction, at her invitation, he wrote these romances. And it used to be thought that he invented them, but it's now known, and it's been proven over and over, that he did not invent them, that they were themes that had come to him. And he tells us where he gets them. And I'll give you the list of his stories. This is practically the outline of the Arthurian traditions. His earliest story, his earliest romance, was the Tristan. This is the key romance of the courtly love tradition. And I'll have something to say in a moment. His Tristan is lost, but we have a whole spate of Tristan romances. One of the most important is by Robert of Britain. And the greatest is of Gottfried of Strasbourg. And it's from that Wagner took his Tristan. Perhaps I should tell the Tristan story right now and then go on with the rest of Kretien later. And I will tell the Tristan in the way of Gottfried, and you'll see the sense of this thing. Tristan is the nephew of King Mark. So we have the nephew motif again. Just as Diarmuid was the nephew of Finn. Tristan was born in Brittany, the hope of the Britons. His father died before he was born, and his mother died after he was born, so he was a kind of little orphan with great brilliance. I mean, he could, when he was young, he could play every musical instrument there was. He knew all the laws of hunting, how to slaughter deer, and all that. He was just a brilliant, brilliant young man, particularly great on the harp. And when he came to the age of about 15 or 16, his advisors suggested he go to his uncle, King Mark. So he goes to Cornwall, where his uncle, King Mark, is in charge. Now, Cornwall had been conquered by Ireland, and the King of Ireland exacted tribute from Cornwall. And the tribute consisted in a certain number of young boys and girls to be taken to Ireland and to serve in the Irish court. You recognize a model here? This is the Theseus story from the Greeks. The Greek material is in the background of so much of this. You know, the story of Crete having conquered Athens and all this, and Theseus is going now, having come from the Peloponnese to his father in Athens, he is going to go to kill the Minotaur and so forth. Well, that's what happens here. When Marholt, who was the Irish emissary to take the tribute, arrives, Tristan says to his uncle, "Let me go and fight him." Well, the uncle was really very nervous about this because Tristan is just a youngster, but he finally acceded, and the two of them are taken out to a small island, and there the pair of them, the two champions, are going to ride at each other. Now, Marholt's sword had been poisoned by the mother of Isolde. Isolde was the daughter of the King of Ireland, and her mother's name was Isolde also. And the mother, Isolde, was a witch. She could prepare love potions, but she could also prepare death potions. In fact, it's the same potion. The sword of Marholt was anointed with this poison. Well, the two ride at each other, and Marholt's sword comes smashed down on Tristan's thigh, and Tristan replies by bringing his sword down on Marholt's helmet. Goes crashing right through the helmet into his skull. And he leaves a little nick of his sword, a fragment of his sword, in the skull, so that his sword now has a kink in it where this thing has come out. Marholt's dead. So Marholt's carried back to Ireland, and his little niece, Isolde, who loved her uncle, when the piece of the sword was pulled out of his head, she took it and put it in her little keepsake box, where she had all those things that so many young ladies have, and she kept it there. Her uncle was dead. Tristan, however, is beginning to stink. The wound festers, he becomes gangrenous and so forth, and he says to his uncle, "Mark, just put me in a little boat, and the boat will carry me to the one who prepared the poison. And she, not knowing who I am, will cure me." Well, so it was. He put in a little boat, and he's playing his harp, and pretty soon that boat appears out there in Dublin Bay. The people hear this this music out there, and they go out, and here's this strange young man playing the harp. And they take him to the queen, who is a sorceress, as I've said, knows how to cure people as well as how to make it tough for them. And she takes him in a kind way, doesn't realize that it's her poison that's the trouble here. I don't know why. She wouldn't have a story if she did realize it. And so when his wound is not stinking anymore, so the people can endure to be in the room with him, she invites her daughter Isolde in to hear him play, and he plays the harp so beautifully. And this, Godfrey says that when Isolde appeared, he played the harp better than he ever played it before. The pair have fallen in love, but don't know it. I don't know whether anybody in this room has ever had that experience, but it has happened. All he knew was that this was a wonderful girl, and her mother suggested he might teach her the harp. So he teaches her how to play the harp, and when he's cured, he goes back to his uncle. Oh, I met such a wonderful girl in Ireland, she should be your wife. Now, what a stupid thing to do. He was crazy in love, didn't know it, thought it was he was in love with the girl for his uncle. So his uncle says, well, fine, go back and get her. So he goes back to Ireland to bring Isolde back to his uncle, who had never seen Isolde. Isolde had never seen him. This is regular medieval marriage. No meeting of the eyes. Well, he arrives in Ireland, and Ireland is troubled at that time by a dragon. And the king of Ireland has said, anybody who kill this dragon can have my daughter as his wife. Well, there was a seneschal, a kind of knight in the court, who wasn't very good at killing dragons. In fact, all he had to do was see a dragon, he'd run the other way. But he was hoping to be around when that dragon was killed, because he wanted Isolde. Tristan arrives and hears the message, so goes to work on the dragon, and that dragon fight is just wonderful. He rides at the dragon brings his jaw down, chops off the front half of the horse, but Tristan's lance goes right into some vital point and the dragon dies. Enormous thing all over the countryside. And he opens the mouth and he takes the tongue out to prove that he is the one who killed the dragon, and he puts the tongue in his shirt. Now, you shouldn't do that with a dragon's tongue. The dragon's tongue is poisonous. So this poor, stupid Tristan, he's walking back to where he thinks the castle might be when he's overcome with a fainting and he falls into a pond, and all that's sticking out is his nose. He's poisoned again. He has a way of getting poisoned. Well, Isolde and her mother, the other chap, he's around, he heard all this noise and lashing of dragon tails and things like that. He comes, and when he sees the dead dragon, he turns and runs 100 yards and thinks, oh no, he's dead, and comes back and saws his head off, not noticing there was no tongue inside, and brings the head in triumph to the court. Meanwhile, Isolde and her mother, Isolde, are out for a stroll. They pass by the pond, they look down and say, oh, there's a nose sticking out there. And they drag this chap up out of the puddle. And they take him home. And with that compassion that is so characteristic of Queen Isolde, they start healing him. And there comes a wonderful episode. He's getting on pretty well. And he's now in a bathtub. He's that room there in the bathtub. Meanwhile, Isolde is fooling around, and she pulls his sword out of its sheath, and my gosh, there's this nick in the sword, and she goes to her little treasure chest and takes it out, and it fits exactly. This is the man who killed my uncle. So she takes that sword, the big heavy sword, and she goes in. He's in the bathtub, and she's with the sword, and he thinks fast, and he says, you kill me, and that other guy gets you. The sword was getting heavy anyhow, so that was that. Well, then came the great event of the claiming of the bride, and this other chap comes in with the dragon's head like this, and Tristan just says, let's see what's in his mouth. They open the mouth, there's no tongue. Presents the tongue and gets his soul. So now, instead of having his soul for himself, he's bringing it home to his uncle. And her mother thinks, well, I'll prepare a love potion so that Mark and Isolde will love each other. This will be a love marriage as well as a marriage. Well, let's put in charge of a accompanying nurse, Brengain. Brengain, on the boat going back, neglects her duty. The love potion is there. The couple think it's a glass of wine, a bottle of wine, and they drink it. Now, those of you who've seen the Wagner thing know they're like a pair of lions going at each other. Not this pair. This is a pair of youngsters. They don't know what has happened to them. They feel sick. And it's gradually coming over them that something has happened. And it's Isolde who gets the message first, and she says, Je crois que c'est le mer. But she pronounces le mer, the sea, in such a way that it'll sound a little bit like l'amour. Tristan hadn't caught on yet. Presently, Bringain, the maid, comes, and when she realizes what has happened, she is appalled. Because the marriage is going to have to take place, and here's the love over here. Now comes a wonderful statement in the Gottfried story. She says to Tristan, you have drunk your death. Well, he says, I don't think I know what you mean. If by death you mean this pain of love, that was the great thing to get, and hang on to it as long as you can. The agony, the pain of love. This is my life, he says. And if by death you mean the death we will suffer if adultery is discovered, because that was punished in the Middle Ages by death, I accept that. And if by death you mean eternal death in the fires of hell for the sin of adultery, I accept that too. That's the strongest statement in the Middle Ages of the affirmation of love. There's a thought that comes from Meister Eckhart that always comes to my mind when I think of that moment of Tristan. To suffer in hell for eternity while being in love and for love. You know, when Dante in the Divine Comedy gets to the circle of the love, the carnal lovers, on flames of wind, flaming wind, come the great lovers. And are they really in pain? Blake says in that wonderful section of his work called The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, when I was strolling through the fires of hell, which to angels seem so painful, Meister Eckhart says, love knows no pain. That's a beautiful word. And this is already stated in by Tristan there. Okay, they've drunk the potion. They're in love. The marriage takes place. I won't go into all those details. And they are having their affair off on the side. It's recognized. King Mark, he's a noble person in this version of the story, so loves the two of them that he sends them out in the forest. He won't have them killed. He says, just get out of my sight. And so now we have the wonderful period of the forest years of Tristan and Isolde. Wild love, but more than wild, mystical, wonderful love. They come to a cave that was fashioned by pagans in the good old days. And over it says, the chapel for lovers. And the cave is built in such a way, a car.